So Frank Tolan insisted on leading the credits. As all great producers do.
Yeah, I always cringed at the at these, you know, these vanity possessory credits.
Right.
It was incredibly stupid, but, you know, it's like, well, my agent said, well, I'll give it to you, you got to take it, so.
Yeah. This this actually conjures up something that we haven't talked about, which is they misspelled Schwarzer, right, in the scroll?
Yeah.
Which is funny to me. But also, back of the VHS cover, which is, you know, also in a encapsulation of what the movie's about, like this, is just one of the great VHS cover text, like, examples ever. Like, the way it's written is so fun. And it's so crazy. It's great. Huh. So, was that you? Who wrote that? Was it some marketing guy?
I really don't remember. I mean, I used to do that. During the writer's strike in 88, I took a job as the creative director for a company that did all of Disney's film marketing. And so I cut trailers and, you know, did all the promo stuff. And I have no idea whether I did that or not for the VHS.
It's talking about, you know, with the situation with the Buzz Cola and the punks, and it says, but no way, dude, can they stop their most awesome party? And it's like,
No, I didn't write that.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
And I didn't write that.
And I was begging Vinegar Syndrome to keep that same synopsis on the back of the Blu-ray.
Do they have the trailer? I have a VHS. The trailer was pretty good, actually.
I would think they do, but we better check. Yeah, because, like, I mean, there's got to be a complete, perfect representation of this film. This is the time.
Yeah.
So this scene, you start the movie with kind of like a Jaws, you know, parody, like a sinister theme.
Yeah.
For comedy.
Well, it didn't originally open this way. The first cut that we did started with vintage surf footage, you know, Malibu Beach, Woody's, you know, girls at the beach, the, you know, guys combing their hair at Malibu. And then went straight to this, to the marching band. We shortened it and punched it up and moved that. That's a duplicate scene of the, you know, the Jocko and Becker scene. But you can see their, you know, their faces are blurred out, so we could, you know, use it. I mean, it's pretty obvious if you...
And your heroes, especially Johnny Bakehead, let's be honest, he's the hero of the movie. But this is your first shot of the crew. But it's funny because the movie is like, you know, you focus on these guys, but then it's very much Eddie Deason's story and Linda Carriage's story, and it just kind of has a lot going on for being such like a rampaging comedy.
Yeah, well, the other way to look at it is that it, you know, makes absolutely, it has no plot and makes no sense whatsoever, which I think, you know, some of the reviewers focused on. But yes, I mean, I had a friend who was actually a film scholar who was convinced. He said, you know, it was Brechtian. I still don't understand what he meant by that, but...
Maybe just the fence-eating part was Brechtian.
Yeah, probably.
So, Corinne Bohr ended up in a lot of stuff like this, but it's funny, I talked to her one time. Actually, I was asking her if she wanted to discuss Surf 2, uh-huh. And she said, oh, yeah, I've seen that one. And I'm like, well, yeah, you're in it. And she's very on top of things. And she's like, you know, I just don't have a memory. She's like, I made like so many movies over such a short period of time when I was young that I just like, it was like an explosion, you know?
That's hysterical. Really?
She's like, it's like if you're a grade school teacher and you're asked to recall one child's mannerisms from 30 years ago. She's like, good luck, you know? But she said it, you know, she remembered having really great time with me because it was one of her first.
Right, sure.
This and Joysticks and, oh, there's Tom Villard.
Yeah.
And then the guy on the left,
Ralph Seymour.
Yeah, he was in Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah.
And later on, Pee-wee's Playhouse as that Randy, the jerk puppet.
Yeah.
So he was really funny, and he was a good physical comedian, but he ended up just doing more voice work. It's interesting. And then Tom Villard, you know, he ended up, for 10 years, he was in a ton of stuff. Yeah. He was even on the Golden Girls.
He was a really talented guy.
Yeah. So you cast Eric Stoltz because of the strength of his... character in Fast Times.
Right.
But then tell us about
Jeff.
Yeah.
So Jeffrey, you know, it was, excuse me. No, it, you know, like I said, it was really, so this was all second unit thrown in after the fact. Not that. we definitely shot big heads, but the tits were an add-on.
But it was really just to get more audience in there to show Johnny Big Head's butt. It was really,
yeah,
that was a cash grab.
Right.
But you're going to tell us about Jeff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it was surprising that we did not have a bunch of deadheads, you know, deadhead surfer types show up. But they, you know, so we were lucky to find Eric and Jeff.
And then suddenly Lyle Wagner comes out with Horshack, if we can call Ron Palillo by his Christian name.
Yeah. So. Yeah, Ron was not happy. He just didn't have enough lines. You know, he was used to being a TV star.
Right.
And he just was desperate to have more to do. But, you know.
Well, he definitely mugs a whole bunch.
Yeah, well, that's what he was there. Inspector Underwear, that's what you got to do.
He also, he got the most Garbage Pail Kids type name out of everybody in the movie.
Right.
But, so Chief Lawyer Dean, Inspector Underwear, and then Cleavon Little's, what's his name? What's his name?
Daddy-O.
That's right.
Mr. Daddy-O.
Mr. Daddy-O is the best.
Yeah.
So this is like, so parents watching this movie over their kids' shoulders, that would be a shot where they'd say, no, all three of those guys. Because from, you know, CPO Sharky had just ended, right?
Right.
And so, you know. Sorry, that's Isaacson, right?
Yeah.
So Peter Isaacson is kind of come off sitcom network television, doing stuff with Don Rickles, comes in to do this movie. I mean, Cleavon Little had Blazing Saddles, of course.
Right.
And then what was funny about, the interesting thing to me about Lyle Wagner was he was such like a handsome action figure looking man.
Yeah.
But he loved to do comedy. He didn't have to.
Right.
He could have been just kissing ladies.
Yeah. No, he was really a funny guy. And you know, he was up for anything.
I mean, he seems like he's having the best time. And then he goes and makes his real fortune off of the Star Wagons.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot all about that.
Which is crazy, which is, it's just the, you know, trailers that actors would use on set.
Yeah.
And restrooms. And his name, they sold wagons with 2 G's, which everybody's
always confused. The Wagoners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was his empire, eventually. So then you cut to real surf footage, which is something was important to you to actually have this represented, right? Not just all be.
Well, this was all, you know, Scott Detrick went out with the guys, and you know they shot it all second unit. There were some really good surfers in there. I think they went down to Trestles, and you know I was jealous because I never got to get in the water the whole time. I mean, when we were in Paradise Cove, there was an epic swell. I mean, it literally almost wiped out all our generators, and I couldn't get in the water.
Was there an audience of people that were like, because there was surf movies, that was a thing from like, you know, Endless Summer and North Shore, and that was its own genre, very well established. But were there people from that crowd that found this movie and like kind of embraced it?
That I don't know.
I mean, they could have though, because there's like this legit footage in here of that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I really don't know.
So Johnny Big had already bit the fence, but for me, it's this the arcade scene where the movie really kind of shows you what it is, shows its cards.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just like the characters just being like 10 times themselves, and then you bring in the first of your new wave influence.
Right.
She was Deborah Harry inspired, right? This character?
Oh, who? Sparkle?
Yeah.
The Linda Carriage character?
I mean, it had to be, right?
I guess.
The punks.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember, you know, what I drew on to, I just knew she had to be, I had to distinguish her from the, you know, from the other girls in the thing.
Right.
And so.
Oh, so good.
I wish they had put his makeup, you know, extended his makeup down to his collar there.
Well, you know, time is money when you're zombie surfer.
Yeah, exactly.
So is that supposed to be their skin?
I don't know.
Oh, that'd be great.
I don't know.
So, and this was not long before Eric Stoltz got the Back to the Future lead, which he then ungot. I think that was only like a year and a half later or something.
Well,
did you know about that?
No.
They filmed for a week where he had the Michael J. Fox role.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah. And they guess they wanted somebody shorter? I don't know. They switched it. Oh, okay. So the Buzz Dads, which are my secret favorite characters in the movie.
Yeah, the dads. So. This we shot in a... it was an abandoned water treatment plant in El Segundo, and the place was really rank.
It just stunk.
It was just nasty.
Well, but the beach footage was not far from El Segundo, right?
We were all over the place. The previous scene was in Paradise Cove. So the surfing stuff was done down at Trestles. The beach stuff that we did was mostly a Paradise. We did some in Venice. We did some, I think, the arcade stuff we did in Redondo on the pier. I think. It was a night shoot, and I was not totally present.
And then, you know, tell us about, like, casting the Buzz villains. Like, Biff Maynard came from comedy scene.
Yeah, he was a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
And he was just, you know, he walked in, he was hysterical, and we said, you're hired. It was really not particularly difficult, you know.
Also,
and Morgan was a friend of George's, and they had worked together in the past. And he was just a great guy, and the two of them got along fabulously. I mean, those two guys just, they bonded. They were the dads. And I didn't really have to give them anything other than, you know, action and cut. That was it. They just did their own thing.
Who ended up with the fake ambulance video game, which really doesn't look like a video game at all? Hey guys, let's play ambulance.
but I don't know.
You don't still drive that around town?
Yeah, it's in the garage.
So you create this character that all the female characters dislike, everyone's skeptical of, but she's still likable. Like, she's still relatable. And she is, like, the dramatic center of this movie, which doesn't really necessarily need one, you know, for the type of comedy it is.
Right.
But she has, like, all of this angst and...
Right.
Yeah.
She actually has an arc. She's the only character that has an arc.
That's true.
And actually, you know, you asked who I modeled her after. I think the line, you know, you look like the Sanyo girl, only better. When Eddie says to her, so I think that's who she's, you know, really what it's all about.
And it's funny because Eddie Deason was, I mean, I don't know if he's like the big name of the movie, but he certainly, you know, brought it a lot of its comedy, you know, integrity and like street cred. But you kind of save his reveal as if it's going to be like Christopher Lee or something, and then instead you get Eddie Deason, which is great. So
we shot this in Rancho Park at the public pool there, and then this was all stock footage that we found. I mean, this was just an incredible stroke of luck finding this.
Stock footage, I wonder from what?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, like it looks like Japanese kids movie, like.
Probably. You
know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And all of this stuff, it's shot all very, you know, all the lighting and stuff down here. I mean, of course, it's murky and blue because it's in the ocean, but it's like, these scenes are really dreamy. Kind of weird. Like, they feel, I mean, you know, just the stuff down here feels like it's, you know, like, there is a sinister aspect, even though it's them. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
It's just funny. So is this at the same plant where the Buzz Cola stuff was?
No, this we, let me think, where did we, wow, you know, I really, this was a set, and I don't remember where we built it.
You know, it's funny, I just realized, in every scene, Eddie Deason pretty much has a different hat, for the most part.
Yeah.
He's like a Sidney Lumet thing.
Yeah. My homage to Sydney.
He was very flattered.
Yeah.
So Eddie Deason, we were talking about him, how that he's always him. So were there parts where you're trying to get him to emote something else and he could just, and it was just,
no,
he goes on way?
No, it was just, you know, bring Eddie on.
Right.
Let him do his thing.
Oh, and then this is the notorious scene.
Yeah, you know, and they did this like in one take. It was amazing because they were so determined to get this right. They just, because there, you know, there are several instances of the split screen, and we thought, you know, it was going to take forever, and we had allowed extra time, and they just knocked it out.
Yeah, this is definitely when somebody sees the movie for the first time. This is one of the scenes that they talk about afterwards, because it's like, you assume that there was like 48 takes of this right off the bat.
And like I said, if you did it today, you would never do it this way. You wouldn't have to do it this way.
Right.
But that actually, you know, was just, we built a set and they came in on either side of that partition. It wasn't a full partition, obviously. It was just a pole to represent a wall.
Right. I still like to believe that this was done with a solid wall, though. It makes me
Well, I like the refrigerator is great. That was really funny. And the subsequent...
Oh yeah, the other angle version.
Yeah, yeah. And the next time we go to it, when they look through the refrigerator. And this was a fun bit. I mean, you know, cutting the roof off the Cadillac. I never thought we'd be able to do it. You know, be able to afford it.
I'm so glad to hear that Johnny Big Head was based on a human being. The actual person that somebody encountered.
Uh-huh.
Because he's so... And that actor's really great. He'd get little tiny bit roles. He's in, like, you know, a horror movie called Superstition. He's in a bunch of stuff. But, like, he's really fun in this movie.
Oh, man. Josh was the best.
And then he didn't act much after, like, 87, 88.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so, he really got into it. He was just... You know, he was a find. I think, you know...
There's Terry Kaiser, who spent a lot of time on the beach in other movies as Bernie.
Yeah.
He's like a crazy trained actor. Like, he was like, you know, Juilliard sort of guy.
Oh, and a real sweetheart. I mean, Terry could not have been just a nicer, more enthusiastic, you know, he was just such a great guy. And really into it. And I remember him saying to me at one point, and I always felt like, well, this guy's a pro, you know, this guy really knows what he's doing. I feel like a complete, you know, faker here with him. And he came up to me after one scene, he goes, you know, you just bring out the best in me. You've given me such great direction. I thought, I don't know what I'm doing. and you are, you know, a real actor. So I said, thanks, but.
Would he, because he was so experienced, would he ad-lib, or was that mostly like kind of the type of thing that more Biff Maynard would do, or, you know, those kind of guys? Were you letting people have the freedom to throw stuff in?
They all had the freedom to, except for Ron.
You told him to rein it in.
Yeah. But Terry really wanted to nail it down. He wanted to know what I wanted, you know, exactly how it should be played. Whereas, you know, Biff and Morgan just, you know, just sort of went off on a tangent. And
it must have been hard to keep up with those guys because, like, oh, wait, we hadn't talked about Fred Asparagus yet.
Yeah.
He's one of the great Hollywood fat guys, which I don't know if it's okay to say that in 2021. I don't know.
Yeah, you could, a round person.
Yes, a person of roundness.
Yeah.
But he played like the token fat guy in all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But his name was Fred Asparagus, which is like...
I know.
It can't be true, but it's true.
Yeah.
I love it.
He died young.
Yeah, he did. It was like, because he was in Three Amigos, so it was like his big role.
Yeah.
He's the bartender and that, and then he just... Did he die of a heart attack?
I don't remember.
Whoops, I accidentally did this thing. And then the guy on the right, of course, is Dorfus from Joysticks, which is one of the other great 80s wild comedies with Corinne Borer in it. You see a lot of his butt in this film. You had to get a special permit on the beach for that day.
Yeah, this was at Paradise Cove. Well, we had good control at Paradise. That was, you can see the pier there. Yeah, the final scene, when we put everybody in the water, uh-huh. the day after a 15-foot great white was sighted from the pier.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Just a fan of movies.
This was on Venice Beach.
I fantasized that you still had like six packs of Buzz Cola just kind of all over your house, but
yeah. Well, I was into this more, you know, as an entrepreneur. I thought, well, the movie will be fine, but I'm going to make my fortune with Buzz, and that never, unfortunately, that didn't pan out. I mean, you know, when we were there before Jolt, and yeah. before you know the energy drinks, and
it should have been you.
It should have been us.
That would have been your, like, Mike Nesmith has the liquid paper fortune. You could have had the Buzz Cola one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was definitely an idea ahead of its time.
And hopefully it would have turned people into garbage-eating punks, which would have only been a bonus.
No, we just, you know, it would have been Red Bull before Red Bull.
Yeah.
I mean, Buzz Cola.
So, was there any actor in the movie that people were... like specifically excited to work with or intimidated by? Because like you did have a lot of first timers versus a lot of, you know, established actors. Like, were people freaked out to work with Lau Wagner or even Eddie Deason? Or
I don't think so. I, you know, the there was a tremendous camaraderie on the set, and everybody was having such a good time that I think if there was any intimidation, it was, you know, dispelled really early. And one of the principal, you know, reasons for that was Peter Isaacson. Peter just kind of, he was like the MC in charge at the catering table and, you know, craft services. He just kept everybody loose and laughing, and he was just such a great guy.
And he's enormously tall, right?
Peter's very tall, yeah.
Maybe the tallest of all the... great movie nerds, great TV nerds. It's funny because, you know, giant nerds include also Weird Al Yankovic and Conan O'Brien are like enormous.
Yeah.
They're like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Peter's gone on to be an, you know, enormously successful producer. He was telling me the last time I talked to him, he had just finished some giant shoot for National Geographic in Egypt. Something to do with, oh, Hilton. I won't get it right, so I won't even go there, but
so he,
that was a dig.
He didn't do a lot of acting after this, though.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, he and I actually came kind of close to getting a deal on two TV shows together as, the, you know, as creators. CAA sent us out and put us together with, I can't remember who. And it was one of those things where the deal took forever to the point where when we actually got together with the producers they hooked us up with, they said, well, the buying season's over, so we'll just get together in 9 months.
And that was
pretty much the end of that.
Right.
This was Eric didn't drink, had never been drunk. And I just thought for this scene that they should be drunk.
Right.
And poor Eric, he just did not feel well. I mean, he got drunk so fast. I think I had somebody bring a bottle of Jack Daniels or something onto the set. And
so does that mean when they have the great line reading of "You guys are nude," that was like actual drunken talk?
Yeah.
I love that line.
Yeah.
That's one of those, there's like certain lines that on paper you're like, okay, yeah, sure. But then when somebody says it in the movie, it makes it so funny. And that's for me that, like, I didn't expect the funniest line reading the movie to be from Eric Stoltz. Like,
yeah. You got all these actors. No, Eric was completely shit faced. I mean, I felt bad afterward because I don't think he felt very well.
Well, you know, it was going to happen someday.
Yeah, someday, yeah. I don't think he made a habit of it.
So, have you ever. I mean, obviously, he, you know, became a, you know, studio actor and everything. But have you ever heard his take on Surf 2?
No.
I'm curious.
No, we never talked about it. I've spoken with Eric since. But no, we never talked about it.
I wonder.
I thought, you know, for me, Surf 2 was, you know, just kind of a gray zone. It was, had great potential, and when it didn't, you know, really take off, because we came real close to a studio pickup. Mm. Yeah, I think it was Warner's. I can't remember. I mean, they had a bunch of screenings, and I mean, they took it very seriously. And you know, it had been a very, you know, they would have recut the movie, but it would have been a very different legacy, and certainly kind of had a different impact on my career, as opposed to something that I was never supposed to speak about in public, according to my agent.
Is your agent still your agent, or has that expired?
No. Oh, no.
The statute of limitations on Surf 2 has been lifted. So it's funny to know that Ron Polillo was like seriously mugging for every inch of camera he could have throughout this.
Yeah.
But so you had, there's like clearly two generations of comedy in the movie. Like, you know, it's a teen movie for sure. But then you had all these recognizable people for Parents. Was that like a calculated thing where you wanted it to appeal to both generations? Was that a producer move?
No.
Okay.
No, it was just, you know, I mean, when Lyle Wagner came in and said he wanted to be, you know, Chief Boyardee, yeah.
And I know that I bring her up a lot because I'm silly, but okay. Ruth Buzzi.
Uh-huh.
That was exciting. She had been a really...
She was a big star.
Person. Yeah, I mean, from after Laughing, she was on all the Dean Martin roasts.
Yeah.
All that stuff.
And just so, you know, accommodating, so sweet, so just no attitude at all. She was just great. She was just, and funny, really genuinely funny person.
Yeah. And she doesn't ever have scenes with like just her and Biff Maynard. It seems like that would have been just total chaos.
Yeah. Yeah. The closest it came was the four of them arguing, or six of them rather, out in front of O'Finley's, which, by the way, when you see Terry up on the ladder, they did misspell. We'll see it when we get to it. It's before the beach party. But they misspelled surfboards. We looked at it. I think they left out the F, so we stuck Terry up on a ladder and said, you know, we'll start the scene with you painting the F in.
That's funny. I've seen real businesses with this sign misspelled, no joke. There's a pizza place that blew their own sign back home. So they're in good company. Where'd you get, so the crew, this is the type of thing that comes up in a commentary more than an interview.
Okay.
But were the crew mostly kind of like young, excited, fresh faces, or was it kind of a mix of people, or?
It was a mix because, you know, Alex Phillips, the DP, and his group, they were very seasoned. In fact, he had shot, well, he had just come off of Diner, I think. Sam Peckinpah came to the set at one point because Alex had shot at least one of Sam's movies, and they were friends. They were drinking buddies. Alex was an ex-alky, big time drinker, and you know, I.
I don't I think. Was, you, go ahead.
No. I was really looking forward to meeting Sam, and you know, he showed up on the set, and we were doing something completely inane, and he looked at me like I was insane, and you know, this wasn't movie making.
Yeah, on the other hand, he was known for, like, they'd have to come, you know, wake him up in the back of a car sometimes to get him to direct, so.
Right.
He couldn't give you too much shit.
No.
That's by the way, I don't think you've ever told me that Sam Peckinpah was on the set of your movie. That's crazy. He's one of my favorite directors.
Yeah.
Despite his misogyny.
Yeah, me too. You know.
So this is Tom Villard, like, his, you know, he's morphing into the total maniac, but the motor oil drinking scene is great.
Yeah.
Could have been me, fellas, but I decided to give my life to science. I remember once I was riding this 50-foot tidal wave. I thought I was a goner. And I... Hey, come on in. Come on in, you guys.
What do you say, Schwarzer?
Hiya, pal.
And this is when you establish, of course, the direct line of villainy in the movie. Who? What inspired the surfer look? The post-buzzed surfer punk look. Like, who was in charge of that? This is one of the great over-the-top representation of punks ever.
I think it was probably David and the prop department and Jeff Skaggs probably had a hand in that, but wardrobe. It was kind of a community project, because wardrobe had to cut up wetsuits and stitch them back together and do them with safety pins and.
Any decent beating, like kicking like Gary?
I wanted them, they were originally supposed to be much more sinister, and they were, killing surfers. This was not, they weren't just out to
sell cola.
Yeah. No, they were, doing real physical harm, so, which isn't real funny, so.
There's the Jerry Lewis.
Didn't belong in there, yeah.
Oh, wait, there's a photo shoot.
Right, the yearbook.
Yeah, it's actually her. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. But the Jerry Lewis portrait, you said that's something that came up. Because of getting in the movie, but Eddie Deason was like truly devoted to Jerry Lewis.
Well, that was coincidental because, I think I had had that in the script as his, this was his... his idol, his mentor, and it just was totally coincidental, and was one of the things that, drew him to the part. He was just so into it because he so loved Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, I remember he said that when he was on set for the first 2 days, he couldn't remember his lines. He's like, there were just so many beautiful figures. He said, he couldn't get over it. Was there anything besides nudity that you were told that you had to include in the movie?
No, not really.
It was just that kind of that Corman drive-in rule of like, you got to have it, at least one killing or one naked lady every 15 minutes sort of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, it was pretty much that.
There's a beach movie that infamously Corman produced that the director was not too keen on having too much nudity in it. It was a woman named Barbara Peters, and then she directed Humanoids from the Deep. And Corman had somebody go in and add all the naked scenes after the shoot left the set.
Right.
So.
Yeah, there was some of that here.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
More than you expected?
Oh, yeah.
Oh. That's not fair.
No, that's, it's no point in really talking about it.
Yeah. I have a personal aversion / phobia to frogs. So this is the scene that I've never actually watched.
Oh.
I always look at my floor.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's safe now.
Doesn't Johnny Bighead put one in his mouth or something?
Yeah, well, yeah. No, yeah. No,
he does. That's right. So I didn't know that because I've never been able to watch.
Yeah.
Too scared.
No, props made these great, they made these great gelatin fish and frogs and eels and stuff for this and for the gross out contest.
I am glad that those were gelatin. The gross out contest scene is great, but I'll wait till we get there to talk about it.
Yeah.
So you have like, was he really holding him up?
Yeah.
Peter Isaacson's a tree. He's an enormous man. Because in other scenes, like, Tom Villard looks tall, but then
yeah.
How tall is, like, was Isaacson like 6'7" or something?
Sure he was. Yeah.
Even more so when he's standing on a chair.
Yeah.
So the rest of the teenagers, like, on the beach and the classrooms and stuff, they're just locals?
Pretty much. Yeah, I really don't, the extras, I really don't remember much. This was a fun scene.
Because you have, you've got like three of the powerhouse actor guys goofing.
And this was another one where, they all had to, sort of hit it.
Right.
The timing was really critical and they just nailed it. It was great.
So you said before that most of the stuff you accomplished in fewer takes than you expected or feared.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think there was anything that, you know, was that became a problem that we hadn't anticipated.
That's very unusual for a project.
Yeah. And I don't know whether it was because, you know, everything was so almost out of context or, you know, bit-like.
Right.
That nobody was really worried about continuity or staying in character.
That Buzz Cola commercial is one of my favorite, like, you know, think like movies within a movie sort of things. It's just like, I picture you guys setting up all this stuff just so the person to scoot around in that outfit.
So this.
Oh, yeah. The reveal. It's still magical.
Yeah. See, there's no wall. Yeah. But when you look at it from the...
It's kind of... Well, not, the movie doesn't look like sitcom-y, but this moment definitely feels like...
Yeah, it is.
In a deliberate
it
way,
looks,
yeah.
Looks that way for sure.
Biff Maynard. He... What's amazing about him is his real name seems like it'd be perfect for the character he's playing in this movie.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that was his real name. It might have been his, you know, comedy name.
Like Engelbert Humperdinck's real name is like John Wilson or something. Right. So crazy. And you said that he was freewheeling his dialogue the most out of anybody?
Yeah.
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 He's sure good at it.
No, Biff came up with hysterical stuff. So we just let him go.
Every now and then you'll see him in a movie where he's playing like a very serious role, like a very like laconic character, and
you see it says so it's missing the
surboards.
Yeah,
that sounds more respectable. Not really. Oh yeah, okay, so this is the Tom Villard full force, and he was in his early 30s when he passed away.
I think so,
it's too bad. But this scene, he's like, I think that part of this was in the trailer. There was a commercial on TV. Is that right? Did they?
Could be. It's certainly in the theatrical trailer.
Because somehow there's the shot of him like really going spaz wild here, and then shoving the head through the wall.
Yeah.
That was something I saw as a kid prior to watching the movie, and it made me need to see the movie. Like that was. It really is that moment.
Yeah.
That sells it. It's so good. And you're saying, and this thing, they're scared of him.
Yeah. No, they were convinced he was going to hurt them. And, you know, he was the most mild-mannered, you know, sweet guy. But he went completely berserk.
So good. But you didn't have to even trick him into this. He just went for it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that shot. That's the shot I remember when I was, like, 10 years old. I was like, all right, that's my future. I'm going to watch that movie. It's like, for sure. God, look at him.
And that wasn't... Right. And we just let the camera roll, and he climbed through the, you know, because that wasn't really, it was just, you know, it's supposed to cut after he punches his head through the wall, and then he just kept climbing through.
You know, when people talk about how different cultures are misrepresented in movies and stuff, and if you go into punk, like, that's the moment where I'm like, people acted like punks were going to destroy the universe, and I think, like, you show them that shot, and, like, he breaks a house with his face.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do better than that. Oh, and then this feels very natural because it's like the nerdiest man possible in front of a room full of actual teenagers that don't want him. But Isaacson's a good sport, it seems like.
Oh, he was, you know, really, I can't say enough about Peter. He was just fabulous. He's just really smart. He's really quick. And, you know, he's not afraid to, you know, do whatever it takes. I mean, he you know. He kind of loved being the foil.
Yeah, he's a pretty goofy straight man, but he is kind of like the logic center of the movie, if there is one.
Right.
It's definitely not the chief.
Yeah, he's the one that makes it Brechtian.
Supposedly. So, were you feeling with Eric Stoltz, like this guy's gonna, like, did you feel like he was gonna go places, or was he just... So was he still just kind of a casual, young, handsome guy?
No, Eric had, when he walked in, but, you know, we knew him from Fast Times.
Right.
And, you know, he just had a feel about him.
I think of between The Fly 2 and Surf 2, you should be most proud of Surf 2. As far as his twos go, I think this is his climax. So this goes back to more
his best sequel.
Was this all shot for the film or some of this existing footage?
This was all stock footage.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But, I guess
that's all Hawaii, that's one. Pipeline.
And you had done a good amount of surfing already before this. I mean, obviously, that's what inspired the movie. But there were, at the time, or I guess from the 60s on, entire feature films that would mostly be this footage, right? They just play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there was like a ski version of that came. There was like an era of ski movies.
Right.
The same thing.
Right.
Which now seems unthinkable that you'd fill a theater with people just to watch.
So one of those guys at Pipeline was Sean Thompson, and Sean was one of the stunt surfers in the second unit.
So he's probably proud to have that inserted into that. So this look, I cannot ignore the look that she has for this scene is so good. It's like Xanadu and Gem, the cartoon. It's like, it's everything that new wave girls like fantasized and wanted to be.
Yeah.
It's so cool. And she, apparently, I've heard that Linda Carriage is like very soft spoken and very shy. And then she's like the center of attention in every scene she's in.
Yeah.
But she was also game for whatever?
Linda, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's great too to put somebody, put a leading lady type opposite Eddie Deason. I'm so glad that is the couple. Not a healthy couple, but who is? She's showing her colors as a well-intentioned villainess. Yeah. I hope she still has that outfit. Okay, so then you had everything goes wrong because the punk surfers eat the film, which is so great. It's like, and before Gremlins, is this right? This precede the Gremlins eating the film scene? I think it does.
It must.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Joe Dante owes you $80, I think. Oh, it's so good. So the look everyone's look is crazy in this movie, but you said that was specifically, that wasn't something that you came in with, that you said go wild to like the costume department and everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and this is beautiful.
It was like, how would Eddie have dressed her?
Right.
And this is the, you look like the Sanyo girl, only better. I think that's the overriding theme.
Right.
For Eddie and Linda.
The, with the punk, surfer zombie guys, there was a, the face paint look, which is completely out of left field, because that wasn't something that actual punks did, like the thing. But then a lot of that stuff was adopted by Nordic people who do black metal. Are you familiar with this subculture?
No.
It's a type of heavy metal where you paint your face and it has those angular black lines that are just like the Buzz Cola victims.
Wow.
It's really weird. And that's like a real thing. And when I first saw this, when I first saw black metal guys, I thought, wouldn't that be great if this was secretly the source of their inspiration?
Yeah. And why didn't I get a tribute?
So this is all shot, you were talking about the different locations for the beaches, but as far as when you were shooting stuff, like that's all pretty close to, it was the beaches that were like south of Venice, right?
Yeah, we were down in Hermosa and that was, South Bay.
And that's where all the town stuff was too, like the theater and the stores and
right.
everything?
Right, yeah.
I guess, God, that's so packed. Was there ever any problem like dealing with, cops, clearances, all that stuff, or was that pretty smooth?
No, it really, all our clearances, we never had a hitch that I can think of.
I think you're the only movie that didn't.
Yeah, I don't think we lost any days. The closest we came to getting shut down was the high surf at Paradise Cove, and the great white eating the cast.
Yeah, that would have been a problem. So, and you're talking about this scene earlier.
Yeah.
That was the functioning car. This isn't a Bow Bow moment.
Yeah.
She's been in other stuff. She's been in a fair amount of movies.
Yeah.
She's so proud of her son.
Lucy.
Yeah, it's interesting that he... Because you have three of the great big guys from that era in this movie. With, you know, the two with Fred Asparagus and... Oh, yeah, he's fixing it.
There's the F. And we almost didn't even notice it, you know. It was, right. I can't remember somebody went, wait a second, they spelled surfboards wrong.
That reflects poorly on Terry Kaiser.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's so intense in this movie.
No, he played it very straight. Yeah. I mean, he certainly got it. It wasn't like, you know, he thought he was in on the waterfront, but but he was a disciplined actor.
Yeah. He still teaches courses.
Does he? I heard that he was like off in Colorado or something. And
I think he still does. His website's active. Uh-huh. And then he was in Austin just 3 years ago living there.
Oh.
And he was teaching acting school there too. But of course, no matter how impressive his credit roster is, people say, oh, Bernie, you know, you're the
right.
dead guy.
Right, right. Yeah, great guy.
There had to be another Biff Maynard ad lib when he says, oh, Finley, can you overlate?
Right.
It's such a doofy line, but so yeah. good. So who's the kid who gets just abused by Johnny Big? I mean, it's his brother in the movie, but like that kid.
Oh, Pat Littlehead.
Yeah, Littlehead.
Yeah, he was you know, he was like a BMX bike guy. He was, you know, he was a stunt guy, and had I looked him up recently because I hadn't had contact with him. Yeah, he was, you know, had a, or maybe still does, had a career as a stunt guy.
Because even how old is he here? Is he even 18 yet?
He's probably early 20s.
Okay, because he looks so young.
Yeah, he looked young.
But that part where like Johnny Bacon throws him off the porch, he does that flip into the garbage, is amazing. Yeah. It's like some Hong Kong business.
No, he brought his BMX bike to the set and was, you know, riding around on one wheel, and he was a really good athlete.
And then Ron Palillo and his lecherous ways. So, did you see the movie Joysticks? It came out the same
time. No.
It's funny because there's very few films that have this tone, but there was like for a minute, and it was all independent 80s comedy stuff, where it just had this like kind of like really Mad Magazined out, you know, just like nonstop comedy thing. And Joysticks shares a lot of the same like, you know, one of the same actors, a lot of the same aesthetics.
Huh.
It's just the video arcade version of this.
No, never saw. I'd never even heard of it.
Yeah. It's got that feel, but to me those are two movies that like, you know, exist in the same universe. So good. Where are the Buzz hats now?
I have one.
You do?
I have not that Buzz hat. The one the embroidered one.
The fancier one.
Those I don't know. The dads probably kept those.
Probably sold for millions on eBay.
And I don't know what happened to Eddie's hat from the end. Oh, he probably kept that one.
He better.
Yeah, that was a good hat.
It's like one of the great hats ever. I've already thought about how excited I am for that to come back on screen. Look at that guy. Oh, that's the great line about squeezing the heads. It's
right.
So good. That was yours, though.
No, that was his.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that
if I need any shit out of you, I'll squeeze your heads.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he said, what do you think of this? I said,
that's
go for
so
it. It's great, Lyle.
So eventually, I mean, not even that long after this, I think it was 3 years later, there's a movie that you may have seen, Surf Nazis Must Die.
Yeah.
And they, I definitely feel.
Oh, no doubt.
The aesthetics of these guys. I mean, it's like right there.
Yeah.
That movie's fun. It's interesting. It's not like, you know, it doesn't feel like this in tone. Like it doesn't feel like a rip, but the look was like that on. Uh-huh. That was a producer shot, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Yep. They're not hard to find. They don't match.
Yeah, that's true. So, Beach Party. I mean, a lot of this was inspired by the Beach Blanket Bingo scene and all that.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. All the components are, you know, it's music, bikinis, like all that stuff. But did you try to actually maybe get Frankie and Annette involved in this at any point?
We spoke with Frank Sinatra Jr.
Really?
Yeah, at one point. Yeah, no, we reached out to Frankie and Annette, and they didn't want to have anything to do with us.
See, that's ironic, because it was only 3 years later that they made a movie that was like the lesser version of this.
Right, right.
But it was for, you know, MGM, so.
Yeah.
And they did get Pee Wee Herman in it, so I'll give them that.
No, I don't think they wanted to sully the franchise.
Right, until 3 years later. So this is good, yeah. The and that's the Untouchables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then,
oh
and
boy,
then of course, the gross out contest.
I'm gonna come. I love this scene, but I'm gonna come back to it. The soundtrack thing is crazy. Who ended up being on it? Who coordinated all that?
Michael Arciaga was the, you know, sort of the put the elements together. I mean, he basically drove putting the deal together with Capitol. And then, you know, we just, they gave us stuff to sample and we sort of picked and found what worked.
So, this scene. What were they actually eating anything that was gross? I mean, I assume that's like
no.
A cookie.
Yeah, they were all baked goods and gelatin things. And
I did like to imagine that some of this was actually disgusting.
No.
Just to add to the screen. Oh, man. What I would give for that wetsuit with the flaming.
I think the guys, you know, they ate so much of that stuff, they kind of felt sick afterward. I mean, they just like, you know, they just kept wolfing it down.
Tom Blard has a disadvantage of being a scrawny guy, too.
No, he was game.
Yeah. So
I remember at one point, and I can't remember whether it was Eric or Jeffrey, but one of them almost threw up. You know, that we had to stop in the middle of this thing. Yeah.
It's funny, this whole segment of the movie, the token fat guys are just constantly like trying to involve themselves in breasts because they get knocked out earlier.
Yeah.
For those of you listening, there was just a sad nod to my left.
Yeah.
So yeah, this scene it's like, you know, again, it's like just zany until like, everything's fine until the bird shit sandwich.
Yeah.
And then things take a dark turn. This was as scripted? I assume.
This was, scripted later, though.
Yeah.
Because it tied in with some of the add-on stuff, but yeah.
And these are the gelatin fish you were talking about earlier.
Yeah. The sound effects were really good. They were very convincing.
Now, this scene really does gross people out, although it's mostly when he licks the bird poop on his hand. But, you know, watching the theater, people really react. There was a. I've never told you this. There was a. At the film festival that I produce, we started doing a contest based on this.
Oh, yeah?
It's not called the Surf 2 Eating Contest, but I call it Puke and Explode, where you start with six people and it gets progressively more disgusting until there's only one person standing.
Uh huh.
But I think this was largely an influence for that.
Now, if you looked at the close-up of, I think, the buzz bottle in Josh's hand, it's backward.
Oh, it is. Zoob.
Yeah. And I can't remember why we had to flip it. Maybe it was...
Was the handoff done in a different
angle? Yeah.
You know, if I've watched this 40 times and never noticed it, then...
Yeah, well...
Hopefully it doesn't make it on IMDb Goofs.
Yeah, well...
I couldn't believe when Johnny Big Head lost, it felt like the end of Rocky. Like, it's so unfair. That poor woman gets stuck.
Well, I think there's still a garbage pile there in his memory.
So, did you say once that the beaches were actually pretty disgusting back then? Like there's something rugged? stuff washing up from like,
well, that was factories? Part of, yeah, the beach in Ocean Park, especially just below Pico Boulevard, there was a drain, an outfall of a street drain at Pico, I remember there were days when there's Spaz Attack. He was great.
Craig Allen Rothwell.
Oh my God, he was great.
Yeah.
But there was a cancer cluster among the lifeguards there.
Oh no.
There were days I'd be in the water and the water was literally yellow, with stuff, you know, with chunks. There'd be stuff floating around in it, but it was this kind of toxic yellow, and then these guys, you know, I think there was some kind of brain cancer.
And it wasn't that a company was dumping, it was just whatever was coming through the
system. Well, that was, you know, they got that cancer cluster was what inspired, you know, them cleaning up the bay and heal the bay and all of that, because right. it had gotten so bad.
So this guy Spaz Attack, I'm glad you brought him up, because he was in like, he was a major part of the LA punk scene, but he's also got in Devo videos, just, he could do like a standing flip and land on his back and he had all these moves.
Yeah. No, I remember we were in the, he came to audition. We were in the offices down on off of Main Street, down below Pico, and they were concrete floors. And he threw himself on the floor. I mean, he literally just said, "Well, you know, what can you do?" And he just threw himself on the floor and started having a seizure. And he was hired. If he lived,
he's amazing. And he's still around.
No kidding.
Not in L.A. He was such a fixture of like the punk and new wave scene parties and all that. And then he moved to New York, and he was maybe like the skinniest, most wild-haired guy in L.A. And now he's apparently very large and bald.
Wow.
So you wouldn't even recognize him.
Wow.
But he's a survivor.
Well, he was incredible. I mean, literally, I don't know how he survived. The audition.
Do you see there's a Devo video for the song Satisfaction? They did the Rolling Stones cover.
Yeah.
And in that video, he flips himself on his back on a hard surface like five times. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I was there.
He's a hero. Oh, and then also I love that there is a bunch of the rear projection stuff that is kind of like the Beach Party movies.
Right.
Which
I would have used more of it because it's just so hysterical.
Yeah, that stuff never feels wrong to me.
Yeah.
I love it. But that's, there's no part of this movie that you don't like touch on a little bit, except for the fact that it's not a musical per se. But so this is the most serious scene of exposition in the film, where they finally figure out.
Right. This was the first scene we shot.
Oh, was it?
Yep.
And Linda Carriage, she'd only been in the U.S. for a couple of years, right?
I guess.
Yeah. Okay. I remember all this stuff in here. So this is pretty close to the Gross Out contest. I mean, like, pretty close in proximity.
Yeah.
And it's a similar thing. Was CPO Sharky still on? Because I just remembered.
No.
Okay.
No, this was... I don't know how hot on the heels, but it was definitely after.
There was a punk episode of that show.
No kidding.
And so there's this moment when Peter Isaacson's career is really like riding on the punk wave. There's a point where him and Don Rickles go and see the band The Dickies, who are like this LA
no kidding
punk band, and it's like on the air, and they're trying to figure out what these punk kids are, and they're all scared. So he was really, he had one foot in it. Yeah, I really love all this stuff. So, when you're casting all the punk characters, like what was like, for instance, if you're directing some guy's first day on the set and you're trying to tell him what the punk zombies act like, were you just kind of letting him follow the lead of like Tom Blarder, or did you have a specific vision for what these guys' behavior was?
I don't know. I think I just said zombie. It was like, be a zombie.
Right. But I like the herky-jerky motions.
I mean, if you know, there wasn't a lot of fine-tuning. I think the guys got it pretty much right off the bat.
It really made an impression on me.
And this guy on the table, this was, you know, one of my finest moments as a director, because he's just perfect.
Immobile. This always reminded me of the Scooby-Doo scene where they'd be going after the Harlem Globetrotters that would just pull whatever was needed
right.
out of his hair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter was a good ad-libber. I mean, when he pulled that mirror out and he went, hello, Mr. Beeger, when he looks at himself and then he pulls out, he goes, see, that's the evolution of life, boys. What was it, mammal eating mammal? It had nothing to do with anything.
Yeah, he always clearly would be the star of a Stephen King biopic, but there's always something like he was like having so much fun and everything he was doing. And then I didn't know that. I didn't know that he like just threw himself directly into producing. I wonder why he gave up on performing. I know a woman who dated him for a short time. So I don't think I've told you that before.
No.
Very strange. There's like a friend of mine's mom. And she's like, oh yeah, I know that guy. But what was did Eric Stoltz go directly from this into studio, like lead stuff or? Oh, yeah, because he did The Wildlife.
Yeah. There it is. No, that's not ours. I take it back.
One, yeah.
Right.
You've been so much front page news.
Yeah.
Where'd Buzz Cola come from? The additional Z's.
Oh, I just made it up. I honestly, when I wrote the thing, I thought I could make some money off of this. You know, this is a great idea. This highly caffeinated, you know, cola.
Right.
I got to market this.
Did you actually make any pitches?
No, because you know when the movie faded so quickly, there just really wasn't an opportunity. And then Jolt sort of hit the shelves about, I think within a year or two.
Do you wonder if they were inspired?
I don't know. I mean, we'll never know.
Were you mad?
I just thought it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to get rich off of the movie.
Until now. You know, that happened, by the way, this is a ridiculous tangent, but that happens if you put milk in Tang.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I tried to make an orange creamsicle the other day. Same chemical reaction as the Buzz Cola. And no joke.
Huh.
Real gross. I drank it anyway. I didn't like it. Here we go. That's the one.
Yeah, there we are.
It's so heartwarming to see that framed. It makes me so happy. So they were basically, you're getting a bunch of like kids who hadn't acted a lot. They're up against more seasoned comedic actors. And everyone's just, I mean, you were happy as long as everyone was having fun, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the whole thing was so stupid that everybody just kind of got into the spirit of it.
Right.
I mean, this explanation of, you know, what's really going on.
Of her hidden past?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a time. It was like she and Jenny Wright from Near Dark both kind of came up in, you know, movies around the same time, and they were both like going to be in all kinds of stuff, and then they both disappeared. But she's going to be involved, by the way, in the release of this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, she said she's going to provide commentary type stuff.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. What would people review-wise, like what would they single out as like the positives of the movie? Because you said the reception was good.
I'm sorry.
Like what went over the most with people? Like what did people latch onto that they liked the most about the movie?
I don't really know. I think people either got it or they didn't.
Right.
There was very little in between with this movie. It was either they loved it or it was just the biggest piece of crap they'd ever seen. And
Why choose? This is down, same spot?
Yeah, this is, I think, Hermosa. It's where the Surf City, the statue is down at the bottom of the, at the base of the pier.
And
this was a funny, this really was a funny scene. This was where Biff got loaded.
Okay.
And got into it with Cleavon. I mean, they never, you know, didn't go very far, but we had to pause. You'll see Biff, you can see Biff's eyes are kind of rolling back in his head.
He's just had too many. That's the thing. You know, usually with comedies, like, the parents are just always playing, like, the dry, straight roles.
Yeah.
And this movie, like, just no one is. It's like everyone's wild the entire time. It's so good. Also, I think when the first time I saw it, I was, like, a 13, you know, I was in eighth grade. And I was so excited that an adult made this movie. I couldn't believe it.
An adult under the influence.
Yeah. Well, it's just like you see certain things, and you're like, there's no way that, like, a grown-up would do this.
That's right. Well, that's exactly the problem I had with it for years afterward. Oh, you did surf too.
That came up in pitches and meetings?
Yeah.
Was it ever a positive in those situations?
Occasionally, but
good.
But yeah, very occasionally.
It's funny, there's a 90s movie called Good Burger, and it's about a company that's basically trying to take over their world with evil hamburgers. It's not entirely dissimilar to the Buzz Cola thing. And they uncover the plot because, similar to this scene, they try to sneak one of the burgers out, you know, falsely, but a dog won't even eat it. And that's how they know it's too dangerous to consume.
Yeah.
So clearly this movie inspired everything that came afterwards.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is cola.
This is a very serious moment. And then these guys, I mean, you know, like, we'll see what their fate is shortly, but you've written them as the villains of the movie, even more so than Eddie Deason. Like, they're like the puppet masters of this crime. But then they're so likable as just, like, goof-ass sort of guys.
Yeah. Well, I had, you know, big plans for them in Surf 3D.
You were really gonna?
Well, the dads, you know, the dads have to come back and Menlo has to come back.
Right.
You know, and aliens.
Oh, I'm very glad. I'm very sad to hear, actually, that never got made, but
yeah.
Did you actually start putting together the?
I had a rough idea. So these two aliens crashed their spacecraft into the ocean, and they get hooked on surfing. But they, in order to blend in, I don't know if it was R. Crumb or it was the old Popeye cartoons. They had, like, two hands and a head, and that was it. And so that's what they were. They walked on their hands, and their head was basically up their ass. And so they had an animatronic torso and a head.
Right.
And in order to disguise this big head they had in their crotch, they both wore MC Hammer harem pants. And so it was going to be, you know, Surf 3D, you can't touch this.
All right, it's not too late. Let's get it done. Let's get it made.
And, you know, on their way from a galaxy far, far away are tens of thousands of these MC Hammer duplicates, you know, in their peanut shape. So they surf, they shape these peanut-shaped surfboards, and you've got this armada of aliens coming to their rescue.
I would definitely invest all 80 of my dollars that I have in making that movie.
Yeah.
But there was a moment where, like, George was ready to put together a 3D production and stuff if this movie made financial sense for that.
We actually, you know, wanted to do this in 3D, and it just wasn't feasible.
Yeah.
But if we could, we would have done this in 3D.
It was totally made sense. And that was during, actually, time frame, that was right when there was that big revival around Jaws 3 and Friday the 13th Part 3.
Yeah.
It's great to see Corinne Borer acting, like, savage and, you know, aggressive, because she's such a, like, delicate character usually in everything she's in. She's like this very friendly, lovable little squeaky lady. She gets tough. So you got pro surfers dressed up like the new wave guys too.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, we had this kind of really funky office space on Main Street near Pico, and right across the street was a surf shop, Horizons West. Nathan Pratt, and so he put together the bunch of surfers. They were all really good guys. Like I said, I was jealous. I never got to get in the water.
Oh, this thing is, so that was totally built somewhere, like in a warehouse?
Yeah, I wish I could remember. It was a set. Just where was it? I don't remember.
It'd be funny if you just found it pre-existing, looking exactly like that. Probably not how it went.
Probably not. It might have been in that water treatment plant, just in another part of it.
The reeking one?
Yeah, maybe. But I just completely draw a blank on that.
The rear projection stuff is so fun.
Yeah. It is. It's just always funny.
Yeah, like movies should still do that.
Yeah.
They would never dare. Was there ever actually any of Eric Stoltz and, like, he didn't really surf, right?
No.
Okay.
No, and in fact, the guy who plays Eric at one point, his wig falls off. If you watch real carefully.
Is it here?
Yeah, when he wipes.
This is good.
It might be here.
I'm glad I asked.
I think it was at the end of the surf sequence in that early beach scene.
Right. Okay, so it already happened.
Yeah, it's probably.
Man, he almost got it. He almost bit it. That was dangerous. Just kidding. You had a big premiere night, like, down here, right? Like a locals premiere thing.
No, I think it opened in Westwood at the Coronet. That was the opening night, and. If I remember, it was like, it wasn't a multiplex. I think it was two screens. And they had, you know, the kids just went crazy and ripped the doors off to get in.
So good.
And so I think we played one night at the Coronet. It was just like. But sold a lot of tickets. Not enough to pay for the doors.
Around this time, there was a bunch of movies that came out where the police would consider them like a menace to the city.
Yeah.
And like that Decline of Western Civilization documentary that Penelope Spheeris did.
Right.
They lined the entire block with cop cars before the screening.
Yeah.
Just to try to intimidate everybody. It was just like, they felt like teenagers were the greatest threat to civilization.
Yeah. Well, there was that there was Blackie's, and then there was this Circle Bar just down the street on Main Street, and I think Penelope used to hang out there.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the city had been dealing with a lot of stuff. There was that Cuckoo's Nest club. There's a place that was out towards the beach that was like a punk club right next to a cowboy bar.
Oh.
And every weekend, both those guys would get, both crowds would get out, be drunk, and they would just like beat the hell out of each other for like, I mean, every week.
Great.
Like, these major hospitalizations from these warring crews. I think it became a real concern. There's like local TV specials from the era about the danger of letting your kids become punk and all this stuff. So this fed into that, the cola, transforming your kids into monsters. What else did you keep for the movie? You said you have the hat and can. Oh, look at Biff Maynard going off.
Yeah, he did the little Jack Nicholson here. Um, That's it. I mean, you've seen everything, yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because Biff Maynard, at the same time, Tim Thomerson was an actor that wanted to do comedy, but he looked like a leading man, you know?
Yeah.
Had a Harrison Ford look. And they did this movie called Zone Troopers. And it's both of them playing very serious. And you're just like, these are silly guys. You know, these are fun guys.
Yeah.
But didn't get to use it. Did Eddie Deason, like, fraternize with all the other guys his age, or was he just kind of?
Oh yeah, and I think he and Peter have kept up.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I just love picturing like actual like hardline surfer guys just eating lunch with Eddie Deason. It's an adorable picture in my mind.
No, Eddie was a wild man. I mean, he's a wild man. You know, he lived with a bunch of guys in downtown. And I think all they did was play cards, like, all the time.
Were they? This?
I don't think he did drugs.
No, he's never.
Yeah, I think Eddie was, but I think all the guys he hung out with were just party animals.
That's so funny. You know, he lived with multiple male roommates until, like, 8 years ago. Like,
yeah.
He, like, was like, oh, you know, oh, it's too expensive to get your own apartment. You know, like, he wouldn't do it. So it's so funny.
Yeah.
I hope it's the same five guys. That would have been amazing. Again, Johnny Bighead, the uncredited hero of the film.
Boink. This scene always reminds me.
It falls off.
When I saw some of the footage from the January 6th at the Capitol, I always think of this scene.
That is looking inspired that time. That's not good. Trump is a huge fan of Surf 2's.
Yeah, inspired his presidency.
Yeah, that was the worst sequel possible to this movie. This is good. This is a great scene of comedy chaos, which I always like. And you just said they told people to just do whatever they could do, like break it, destroy it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, total. Mayhem is stuff that doesn't. It's hard to sell on camera. That's so good. Jump over the camera, guys. So I need to ask, because I guess anyone who's watching the commentary has already seen the movie.
Yeah.
In Surf 3D, were the Buzz Cola dads going to be still women when they came back?
Just no. Well, they were just going to be old men sitting on a polluted beach where there were geysers of oil because they had continued on with Eddie after he got out of jail. And he had some formula to somehow release the oil reserves under the beach in a way that it was going to come up through the plumbing of the local showers and bathrooms. And instead, it formed little geysers and it completely polluted the entire coast. And so everyone, you know, they were in hiding and everybody wanted to kill the dads.
Do they ally with the aliens?
I don't know. I have no idea how it goes from there. I figured I would just wing it.
I realize where that drawing that you're thinking of might have come from. The Crumb, or whatever, this guy named Basil Wolverton, who's a cartoonist that inspired Crumb, who did that character.
Yeah.
So Eddie Deason gets to do his Jerry Lewis moves here.
Yeah.
In front of that. And when we talked to him one time, he actually brought up how meaningful that shot was to him. That you did the close-up of the Jerry Lewis portrait.
And uh-huh.
Much he treasured that.
Bless his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really affected him.
Eddie was in all the way.
Yeah. And then a rare, sincere moment between these characters.
Yeah.
So, it sounds like, as far as making a movie that's filled with chaos and, you know, a challenging budget, that you didn't really have any, like, crises.
No.
Yeah.
No, it was kind of a miracle, really. Unless, you know, I was unconscious and, you know, one of these guys remembers something horrible that happened, but.
It's funny, like, because, you know, we talked to other filmmakers about their movies, and like without fail, one of them's like, "Oh yeah, and this is the." I was so tired after the scene that I crashed my car into a tree, and it's like, always these horror, this is a real one, these horror stories.
Yeah.
And it's just like, this movie is just so good natured and so warm that nothing lousy happened. Biff Maynard, great comedian, not such a beautiful lady. That's an unfortunate trade-off for him. And he passed away not that long ago.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a line that I've always wondered about. I don't think I've ever asked you.
Yeah.
Why does he say there are festive dads?
I think Eric ad-libbed that.
That's not what that word means, Eric.
I'm pretty sure he did.
That's such a funny line.
Yeah.
Oh, let's talk about wardrobe.
There it is, the hat.
The hat with the Wonder Bread sweater?
Well,
what's better?
Look at Carol.
Yeah.
She was a sweetheart. And she was very much, you know, everybody thinks Carol Wayne was just this kind of put-on character. Uh-huh. It's exactly the way she was just all,
like,
the time.
Super, like, just
she, you know, she
guys.
And Eddie were just authentically themselves.
Right. People never believe that about him, that his voice is that way and
yeah.
all that stuff. It's like, everyone, you know, it's got to be a shtick. And it's like, no. And it's funny because when somebody's like that, it's like, what else could he have been in life, you know? Like, he had to do this.
Yeah.
And all is as it should be, except for the festive dads. Which is great, because then the movie ends on Fred Asparagus, who gets his shining moment.
Say Buzz.
Okay, I spoke too soon. Biff Maynard is a beautiful woman.
Just imagine him without a mustache.
That would ruin his appeal. And then you have your fancy crane shot.
Yeah. That was exciting.
Yeah. And here comes those wild boys. It's funny, that's Jim Greenleaf on the left.
Yeah.
He is a professional Santa at parades now. He works 1 month a year and makes a full living.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. A much better fate than Fred Astaire, I guess. Sadly. It's funny because is Jim Greenleaf, and then that movie Joysticks I was talking about, he's in that, and one of the other stars is named Leaf Green. It's very confusing.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah. So there's your movie.
Yay.
You're swelling with pride once again watching it. Right? Oh, wait, okay, so this is good. You actually use the local, like, punk, and, you know, just like local popular DJs.
Right.
Like, the poor man is a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Jed the Fish is around forever.
Yeah.
No Rodney on the Rock, though. He wasn't really a surf guy. He was more...
Right.
Yeah, urban. But yeah, so anything that these names conjure up, but usually this is when we start to say, you know, that this was the greatest moment in cinematic history and thank you so much for doing this with us and all, you know, all those things. But if any of these other names bring up a story, tell it.
No.
No, I refuse.
No. I mean, you know, it was just a fluke that God made. What can I tell you?
But it still has a life.
It was a lot of fun. I'm really curious to hear some of the interviews.
Yeah. They're going to, you know, ideally, I mean, God, I hope Ruth Buzzi's game, because she's... I don't know. To get her perspective on this would be really fun.
Yeah.
Because she was such a veteran already. And she's living secretly hidden somewhere in Texas. And
oh, yeah?
Nowhere. Yeah.
Huh. Are you doing her?
If she agrees to it, that I will definitely... I would pay to do that.
That's great. Well...
Yeah.
Well, whoever you do speak with, send my love and my warmest regards.
I will. Oh, and then here, this was the bane of my existence for years, was this...
Oh, right, looking for the album.
Yeah, the soundtrack album.
It's a good soundtrack, it really is.
It really is, yeah. No, people have even bootlegged the Oingo Boingo song as a 7-inch, like, just because they like that song so much.
Uh-huh.
But it was a mix, yeah, like, obviously the Thomas Dolby song was already a radio hit, but then it's crazy how much... There's a lot of original music that was made for it, right? There's, like, several songs?
Yeah, a couple.
The Untouchable stuff was.
I'll tell you, one of the memorable moments was meeting Dick Dale. I went down to meet him at his house at the Wedge down in Newport, and he had a this giant cage in his living room. He used to keep a tiger, and they had recently forced him to give it up, but he still had the cage in there. And Dick greeted me. He was wearing a wife beater tee. He had foaming armpits. And spoke about himself in the third person. He was a very unusual guy, and kind of an idol, because you know he was the father of surf music,
famous for melting his picks because he plays so fast.
He was quite a character.
I'm really glad to hear he owned a tiger. He earned it. All right. Well, thank you a lot for doing this.
You're more than welcome. I'm glad you were here. It would have been very boring without you.